You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Break a Bat podcast, where baseball meets Broadway. An attempt to show that my two favorite mediums don't have to live in such separate worlds and maybe even break some stigmas. We're happy to have you with us. Now let's play ball. Welcome to Break a Bat, coming at you from the Broadway Podcast Network studios. I'm your host, Al Malafronte, and alongside me is my producer, Alan Seals.
That's when I say hi.
Yeah, that's
you caught me with a mouthful of protein bar.
I was going to say, is that the way like you come back to the show? Everyone's been asking about where you've been after the Ashley Williams episode.
scheduling conflict, but right now I have a dinner conflict, which is why I'm eating during your intro.
Mm. Wow, he's such a selfless guy, isn't he? He's a favorite among the batheads, so I'm happy that he's back with us today. And, to be honest, we've got a great show in store for you today because we're joined in studio by a very special guest from the acting world, and I'd say from a baseball perspective, probably one of the more versatile players in the game. Think along the lines of Max Muncy on the Dodgers or even here in New York with Jeff McNeil. He could play a lot of different positions, and more importantly, he could play them all very well. You know, whether it's on TV with The Wire and True Detective, and then, of course, here on Broadway with The Book of Mormon and The Prom. And now, Alan, I don't usually speak for you on this show, do I?
No, never.
The latter. One of our favorites in recent years, would you say?
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Mm-hmm. That's why I'm super excited about this one. So that being said, if you'll please turn your attention to home plate just beyond the marquee. Now batting, Michael Potts. What's up, Mike?
What's up? How you doing?
Good. I mean, I know it's been a few months since The Prom closed, but you know that you got to love that level of theatricality when you come back on 8th Avenue.
Here. Oh, yeah, that was pretty cool. That was pretty cool, way more than I expected, yeah.
Over the top is one way to put it.
Well, it's Broadway.
That's right.
It's Broadway.
What you been up to, man?
Recently, The Prom ended, and then I left a little early to go shoot a movie. And then after that, came back, and I've been doing some guest star stuff on a couple of shows on the broadcast networks, and last week did a 29-hour reading of another potential two Broadway musical, Car Wash. Had that last week, and then I'll be working, totally different change of pace with Randy Eckert on some, another music theater piece that'll be coming up, I think, in the spring. So.
Has it amazed you? You've been in the industry a long time. You mentioned that you do a reading for Car Wash. Some of these movies that they've managed to, turn into musicals over the years?
Well, here's the interesting thing. I didn't know someone informed me a bit of trivia about Car Wash, that it was originally written to be performed as a musical on stage. But it ended up, I don't know if that's true or not, but this is what a fellow actor told me in doing their research, that originally it was supposed to be a musical. And it ended up being a film. Movie musical, well, not even a movie musical, just a movie with music, yeah. This incredible soundtrack. So it's coming home, I guess.
Yeah, and which part did you read for?
Well, in the movie, the role is Daddy Rich. That's the Richard Pryor role.
Oh, the funny one.
So
okay.
In this reading, he's Reverend Rich, as opposed to Daddy Rich.
Reverend Rich, okay.
Reverend, I mean, the role is a minister.
Right.
Was a bit of a minister in the movie. But I think to kind of update it or to take some of the stereotypical spin off of it, it would switch from Daddy.
Yeah.
From Daddy Rich to Reverend Rich.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And you mentioned some of the guest spots too. I know you're a New York guy. Do you like to escape to LA to do those shows that you
Sure. I'll go anywhere that it's a good role and they want to hire me and pay me and fly me out there. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, New York is home. It's home base. I wouldn't want to. I'm not in L.A. That's not my vibe. But I do go out there and visit, and I do enjoy the time that I'm out there, as long as I know I'm coming back home.
Is everyone a lot more low-key when you're shooting out there? I just get the vibe of L.A.
No.
Big budget stuff is always tight.
Oh, just the opposite. Are you kidding?
Wow.
Oh, no. It's very, very tense. Very, very tense, because it is big budgets. Lots of money at stake. And I don't think people realize that it takes a bit of a small army to put together television shows and movies. That's a lot of money. And time is money.
Yeah.
Time is money in the television and movie industry. So it can get really, really tense sometimes.
Did you know that going into it when you set out on this?
No. All of it. I mean, who knows? When you first come out of school, everything is OJT to a greater or lesser extent. Unless you had done something professionally before you went to school, you wouldn't know. So it's baptism by fire almost.
And you've had an incredible career, obviously. And, you know, I know that you're a graduate of the Yale School of Drama. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you had ultimate training. You're viewed widely throughout the industry as, you know, being a consummate professional. You do things the right way on and off the stage, as far as we know. Do you have some scandals that are coming up in attempts?
No, I wish I was that interesting, but no.
You know, I want to get your take on this. You know, in a couple of weeks, it's expected that Derek Jeter is going to be unanimously selected to enter the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've been in New York a long time. You've watched him play. You know, there's a dilemma right now among voters for the Hall of Fame and for fans. And I mentioned, you know, you being a consummate professional for this reason, because Jeter always did it the right way, the captain, sixth all time in hits, 5 World Series rings, all, you know, the whole 9 yards. A lot of people want to give him his moment in the sun, kind of have him be the only one enter the Hall of Fame this year. Whereas, you know, you have other guys who are based on numbers equally qualified, like Clemens and Bonds, but they use steroids. Mm-hmm. For someone who's always done things the right way, I just want to get your thoughts on, you know, how do you feel about this?
Well, it's kind of apples and oranges in a way, because in our business, there are so many different ways to become a star or to get noticed in this business, and not everyone has the same level of craft or skill or nearly as professional. And I think you probably see them every day when you're watching television movies. So I've tried to do it out of this notion of the right way for me has simply been about respecting the integrity of my craft. That's what's most important to me. Subjugating my ego to the idea of the craft, of telling the story. Because I think it honors the profession and, you know, sort of the people who taught me about the nobility of the profession, and I try to carry that on. Excuse me, but I think, you know, other actors may have a different perspective on that. Now, as far as this baseball and Derek Jeter, a lot of these guys who have been inducted, I think they have been with a little asterisk.
Yeah, there's some cloud of suspicions.
A little asterisk next to their name. There can be an argument that the steroids are simply enhancing what is already there naturally, you know, above average athleticism. So it enhances that. But I think if we want to believe in a meritocracy, right? We want to believe that it's about hard work. It's about the natural gift, and it's about the hard work. Then yes, that should be rewarded. I think I would have some questions about people who got in enhanced,
right?
Who had a little enhancement. I wouldn't want to put them on the same level as someone who actually did it, was an all-star, an outstanding player, legendary player, simply on their own merit, on their own hard work and their own skill.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
You talk about respecting your craft. Growing up, could you have ever have imagined, you know, you grew up in Brooklyn?
No, I actually grew up in South Carolina.
I grew up in South Carolina.
Yeah, I grew up in a very, very small town in South Carolina. Born in Brooklyn.
Born in Brooklyn, grew right. up in South Carolina.
Yeah.
To make it all the way to the Yale School of Drama. First of all, what, you know, growing up so far from here, what spurred your interest in theater?
Well, see, you'll find, just as in music, with a lot of African-American singers, the church is the center of most communities, certainly smaller communities. And the church is a performance space. If you've ever been into an African, any church, Catholic church as well.
Sure.
I mean, the costumes, the liturgy, all of that, the incense, it's the ritual of religion. So you grow up in church. And so I began doing the little pageants that we would have. On Easter, we would have pageants. On Christmas, we would have pageants and we would act out, you know, the crucifixion. We would act out the birth of Christ and things like that. So there was always performing. And I sang in the choir, in the various choirs. And so performance had always been a part of it. Getting to Yale and getting to New York, that's all by accident. It wasn't anything that I didn't have a plan for it. And honestly, when I started out, I thought I was going to be a cardiologist. I mean, that was the goal. And boy, did that make my mom very happy, until it didn't. Until I decided that wasn't what I was going to do. So, I sort of got a little bit of the bug in about seventh grade. And sort of fumbled my way just back and forth. Never really took it seriously. Because as I was growing up, there weren't a whole lot of African-American men that I saw on television and in movies. We had Sidney Poitier, I think. And we may have had Ivan Dixon. So it wasn't something, because it wasn't seen as a career in my family, that's not a job. It's not something you do. So you never took it seriously in that way.
How did you convince them? Was it with your talent?
Convince my parents?
Yeah, to let you go out and pursue it, or you just kind of said, screw it, I'm doing it anyway.
Here's the thing. I secretly applied to Yale. I did not tell my family. After high school, I had wanted to go into acting school, and my mom staged an intervention one summer to dissuade me.
Did you, like, get home from school one day and all of a sudden there's, like, everyone in the room?
That's exactly what it was.
Wow.
My mom dishing out food to a dining room full of people, including a neighbor who I didn't understand why she was there. She wasn't related. But it was all to dissuade me from this frivolous pursuit of show business. And so I did. I put it away. For a long time, I put it away and decided to try and went to undergrad and decided I would try to do the pre-med thing and then moved from that to English and was slowly kind of being drawn back into the performing arts. And so eventually I just decided, because of a professor that I had in undergrad who had taught at Yale and brought it up to me. He said, "You want to go to Yale?" And he kept talking about it. I said, "I don't know anything about Yale. I don't know what you're talking about." So, you know, you do a little research. But it still wasn't something that I saw myself doing. And then eventually I did. And, you know, coming back to the whole notion of Broadway again, it was the year that Fences was on Broadway. And I remember watching the Tony Awards that year. And it was James Earl Jones and Courtney Vance doing the scene from Fences. And I remember watching that and being enthralled and went, okay, I recognize these people. These people sound like me. They look like me. I understand this situation. I can do that. And so I decided to find out where Courtney Vance had gone to school so I could do it too. And I found out it was Yale. And a year later, I sort of secretly applied without telling anyone. And figured it was in the baseball, it was a Hail Mary. It was a Hail Mary. It's the only place I applied to. And I figured if I got in, it was one of those moments. If I get in, I'm meant to do this. If I don't get in, then I'm meant to do something else. So that's how that happened.
It's amazing. Yeah, you kind of let the natural progression of the universe take its course. Yeah. It sounds like your parents obviously, they had their mixed feelings, but when you tell them that you get in, at that point, are they just so proud they can't even reprimand you?
No.
Oh, not as much?
No. I think it's my little sister, she was blown away by it. But my mom was like, oh, what are you going to do about your job? Because I think I was working at the city at that point. She wasn't having it.
Wow.
It took her a while to come around. Honestly, it took her quite a while. Nearly the entire time I was at Yale. It took nearly that entire time for her to come around to the notion of, okay, this is what you want to do. I guess I better get behind you. But no, she did. She was not. I get it.
You've played some badass roles on television.
Mm-hmm.
These days, do most people recognize you more for what you've done on screen or on stage?
On screen. And it's starting to pick up. Last few years, it has become more about stage. If I go and see a show nowadays, there'll be people in the audience who will recognize me from something they had seen me in, a play they had seen me in here in New York or on Broadway, what have you. But still, mostly on the outside, it's still about The Wire to these days. I mean, I thank God for it. I'm grateful for it. But it is. It's mostly still about The Wire.
That's actually one of my buddy Gene. That's his favorite show ever, I'm pretty sure.
I hear that a lot from a lot of people. Favorite show ever.
It's interesting. You know, you play a character like that, like Brother Mazone, on the outside. I like to think of this as like a silent assassin in baseball. Like Bernie Williams was the center fielder for the Yankees, mm-hmm. Jazz musician off the field, very quiet, very soft-spoken. His nickname when he came up was Bambi. So, meanwhile, this guy could hit 450-foot home runs and make the All-Star team every year. Brother Mazone on the outside was like so still and so composed, polite, yet he projects an intensity from the inside that feels dangerous. How did you do that?
You get the script, and I think I came upon the character more about little stage directions that the writers put into it, more so than anything I could come. It's just they had a way of saying, you know, he'd say a line, and then you'd have, he looks askance, or he looks off. So they would describe, in a way, what his reaction to a certain thing would be. And I started getting a sense of the character simply from that and just the language they would use. I mean, you would notice they would write him arias and the syntax he would use. So I had that. And then I also had my memories of, old black and whites. When you watch these old shows and news broadcasts and interviews, I've heard Malcolm X speak, so you knew what that is. You've heard the infamous Louis Farrakhan, you've heard him speak. So you start taking that into account, and also where my parents lived in Prospect Heights in Brooklyn, and then I would come into Bed-Stuy to get to pick up the train, and there would usually be, Nation of Islam brothers out there. Selling out the Final Call, I think, is the name of the paper. And so you'd hear them, you'd hear how they speak, how they spoke. So I think that was all in the machine there. And it kind of made sense and fell together with the character.
When you're in the midst of playing a role like that, that's so intense, do you find that your personality changes at all off screen?
No. It's a great thing. Not to name drop, but like Diane Wiest used to say, you wipe your feet. When you leave the theater, you wipe your feet. You leave that there. That's what you did there. And you go out, you wipe your feet, and you become who you are. So no, I didn't feel that I was more intense. My family would tell you, I am so far removed in their minds from that character. I had a cousin who would go, that's not my cousin. Because it did frighten them. Because they didn't know me that way. But in my mind, I'm playing, this is the character. My job, my craft is to embody as authentically as I can that particular character. That's who he was. That's where he lived. That's where Brother Muzon lived. That's not where Michael lives. So I was able to leave that. I'm like, okay, done.
Yeah.
Done. Okay. That's that guy. Okay. Cut. Wrap. All right. Cool. I'm back to me.
Let me ask you the opposite of that. When you're having a bad day, or do you take anything from the outside onto stage with you or into the soundstage?
They would always do that. You know, because we're supposed to be empathetic beings. And if we're open to it, all of that's going to resonate. We're bringing the cumulative of our experience to what we're doing. And so if something affects us in the day, yeah, it's going to have a resonance in how we play. That's why if you go and see a Broadway show every night, there's something a little different in it, you know, over the course of the performance of a week. If you watch it 8 times, you're going to find 8 new things that an actor has done, and it could be because of what happened that particular day. It all resonates because we're using us. We're using all of us. So it will be. The way you keep the consistency of the performance is just how I said, it's about the craft. It's you still have to know what story you're telling, what your objectives are, what your actions are. But yes, there have been days I've walked on stage because, you know, something has happened just the moment before, or something had happened earlier in the day or even earlier in the week that I had, you know, that troubles me. But I still have to go and perform, and so it will show up. But hopefully it won't, but you must not let it spoil the performance, spoil the performance you crafted.
I was going to say, to be able to separate that's just the mark of a consummate pro. Like, as I
well, you know, that's what you were taught. I mean, that's the notion of technique. That's the notion of craft. It will be in there. It will be in. I think television and movies probably appreciate it more because you're going to do several takes and people want whatever is in there to come out. They want to capture something. You know, they want to capture lightning in a bottle. And so if you do it 15 times and that thing that bugs you suddenly comes out in that particular line, they might go, oh, that's amazing. That's the take we want. And they'll take that because they want a mix of things that they can choose from. They want it as raw and as real as possible.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Now, when you've done Broadway and you're in rehearsals and readings, as far as you have your technique, obviously.
Right.
But, you know, how do you put the Michael Potts spin on your characters? Like, for example, let's take with Principal Hawkins in The Prom. And first of all, you know, kind of on the opposite side of the ball is Brother Muzon in many ways.
Very much, yeah. Very different guy.
A lot of our listeners are big fans of The Prom. So how was Principal Hawkins originally written? And then how did you put your own spin on it?
Well, the thing I got Principal Hawkins is the way the director and Casey Nicola, and the creatives, Chad and Matthew, they wanted him to be outside of the world of Broadway. They wanted everyone in Indiana to be sort of middle America, ordinary people who are just been invaded by this and, you know, these over-the-top Broadway personalities. And so it's easy because they're bringing one thing to the table. They're these over-the-top performers, and I'm just this everyday guy in this town in Indiana who's just trying to teach his kids and keep them on the straight and narrow. And trying to remind everyone of their better angels and that letting Emma go to the prom with her girlfriend, what is that? How does that harm you in any way? Who is that? We're all human beings. We're all trying to keep the peace. And so you look at him as sort of trying to be, I don't think, you can't do that. You can't go and I don't think to myself, oh, I've decided I'm the moral compass of the No. It is just, guys, take it easy. This is nothing. This is life. Let's just do what we need to do. This is not a big deal. And so that allowed me to make him sort of an easygoing, normal sort of guy. And as far as Michael Potts, I mean, I tend to be a more steady, easygoing type of person. I mean, I've got a nutty side. I like to laugh. And things like, and so I can be a little, a bit of a card sometimes. But most times it's about being centered and being still and being quiet and being focused. So that's probably what I brought to Principal Hawkins, that with all of this other stuff going on around him, you know, the shouting from the PTA and the parents who are not cool with this, and then the Broadway personalities, their big personalities. It's like, you have to center yourself to try to make sense of the situation and to keep it focused on what was important, and what was important was Emma. Keep the story focused on Emma and her right to be who she is.
That being said, since it sounds like, you know, you kind of talk about, you know, being a pretty easygoing person yourself, when you had to work alongside the South Park guys, Matt and Trey, when you're doing Book of Mormon, completely different ballgame, huh?
Yeah, but that plays into my nutty side.
Oh, yeah.
That plays into the kind of mischievous side of it. No. When I first, I howled, honestly, when I first, and they were very apologetic. They worried that it was too much and people would be offended. And I remember them handing it to me. It's like, we completely understand. It's not for everybody. And if you don't want it, it's you know, just let us know and it'll be okay. And I remember reading the song, Hasidiga, and I howled. I couldn't. I said, you're going to say this on Broadway? And they went, yeah. And I went, I said, if you have the balls to write it, I guess I better grow the balls to do it. It became that kind of challenge. And then when we did it, just the response to it was mind-blowing. It was pretty extraordinary. I've never had that experience before.
Did you see Book of Mormon, Alan?
Oh, yeah, several times.
To this day, arguably one of the three or four funniest shows of all time. It has to be, right?
Well, I enjoy Book of Mormon because they have no shame.
None.
And it's not singling out a single gender or race or anything. It's just everything's messed up. Let's just have a laugh.
And smart. I mean, it's really, really clever because, honestly, when you look at it deeply, they're just making fun of us. They're making fun of themselves and they're making fun of all of us by making it seem as though they're making fun of Mormons in Africa. But no. They're just doing this with a mirror and being shameless about it, you know. No, it was an extraordinary experience.
And now you were in the OVC. Did you ever get any pushback from the Scientology church a few blocks away?
No. They were having their own protests about something else down there. I think one or two people from the Mormon church may have said, but for the most part, I mean, I knew it. I said, the Mormon church, this is going to make them mainstream. They're going to eat this up. Said, and they issued this wonderful statement about, you know, how the Book of Mormon will entertain you for a night, but the Church of Jesus Christ will, you know, will save you for a lifetime, something to that effect. And then they went and put a giant billboard in Times Square promoting the Mormon Church. They were very, very smart. And we got a lot of ex-Mormons who kept coming to the church. Kept coming to the show. So, yeah, we thought we would have more trouble. We had, you know, security gates and everything at the door because we just knew we'd get pelted. I really thought I would after Hasidiga. People would really come for it. No, I think we got two letters that concerned us, concerned security a bit, but that was it. Everybody loved it. People got it. They got it.
And it's still running. Isn't that amazing?
Still running. Who knew? I laugh. I saw, you know, I said, this will last 7 months.
It's become this mega house.
I went, we'll get 7 months out of this. That's about it. Who knew?
So let me ask you this now. You know, I guess to that point, that was your first, that was your first lead, real lead role in a Tony winner to that point. I want to ask you something that's a bit of a sore subject among our fan base here. Do you think The Prom deserved Best Musical going up against Hadestown? Both great shows, but the Hadestown got a lot of love at the Tonys this year.
Of course, I'm biased. Of course, I think Prom should have. I thought the story deserved. And the performances, I think, but certainly the story, I think, deserved more love from the Tonys than it got. Didn't get any, and it should have gotten far more love for it. Hadestown is a wonderful show, and I get the whole Hadestown thing. It's a lot of eye candy with it. It is a Broadway show. You know, there's a lot more, and what I mean by eye candy is spectacle. There was a lot more spectacle on stage with Hadestown. And here we were something sort of old-fashioned, sort of throwback. Wasn't a ton of glitz or projections or things, just easy, basic sets. And the story was the thing that was primary, that was put forward more so than all of the other elements that go into making a Broadway show. Hadestown had all the other elements. I mean, it's a story, you know, Orpheus, you've heard that story's been done before, but it was the lights and the sound and the costuming and all of that. And so I get it. I mean, very, very similar in a way to sort of like Moulin Rouge. Again, it's a highly entertaining show. It's very, very sexy. And, you know, it's what people were into. It's the thing that turned them on the most. But The Prom had its very, very dedicated and rabid fan base. It just wasn't enough to keep it running. So, yeah, I'm biased. Prom should have won.
What was it like working with Beth Level? Because I thought that was one of the best dynamics I've ever seen on stage between the two of you.
I just love Beth Level. Absolutely adore her. Wasn't expecting that. I'd never worked with her before and didn't really know her work up to that point. And it was an odd thing because this was a show that they had been working on for years prior to it coming to Broadway. These were roles shaped around them. I was the newcomer. I came in the last year when they were reworking the role. And so there was already this family and this core of the Broadway people. And so I had to find, how do I find my way into that? Will this work? And we did. I think we hit it off. And because she was so generous as a performer as well, she was present, which is, you know, that's what you live for. Certainly what I live for as an actor is that the people you're actually speaking to on stage are actually listening to you and taking it in and responding in kind. And she did that. You know, and it goes without saying, she's extraordinary to watch. You look at it going, you've got to be kidding. So a lot of those things in that scene where I'm clapping and applauding like mad after she does that, ladies improving, that's just me just in awe. Like, you really are, you're the real deal. You're pretty extraordinary. You're the real deal. I mean, she's a beautiful woman. Beautiful woman, beautiful human being. It was easy. It really was.
Alan, that's one of your favorite numbers in the show, too, if I recall.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah. Did you see Closing? Were you there for Closing?
No, I was still shooting.
I was there for the final performance. And there are clips of it all over the internet, which I'm sure you saw. But it was like a five-minute show-stopping applause.
Oh, yeah.
Just went on forever. I could watch that number. Like, there's something... To your point of being there, being present in the moment, she just delivered that as if it was the first time she was doing it every single night.
Every single night.
Something different. It was always different. It was so good.
No, she's honestly the real deal. There's no question about that. I'm so excited to see her in Devil Wears Prada. Yeah, I'd work with Beth Level again and again and again and again in a heartbeat. In a heartbeat. She's top of my list.
You talk about connection to the audience, and of course you sang the song We Look to You, which is really like a love letter to theater. That must have been pretty cool for you.
Yeah, it was a very, very sweet song. In my head, you know, and I guess people might fault me for not playing to the audience enough. that I should play to the house more. But in my mind, that was a love letter. That was all about Dee Dee for me. And so that's about being in the moment and playing the character for me. I was like, this is my love song to you because I'm falling in love or I've fallen in love with you. And if I do that, my belief is I do that well and I show that, then it will resonate. The audience will get it. I mean, I know certainly looking at it on the page what the intention of it was. I know I am singing about the relationship between the audience and a great show and a great story. But as the performer, it had to be for me about Principal Hawkins and Dee Dee.
I'm curious to get your take on this about maybe, I guess, the way that they're teaching certain performers, you know, coming up through the pike. Have you seen a big change in technique over the years that, you know, has either, you know, in some ways pleased you, in some ways, you know, upset you a bit being the pro you are?
Yeah. I'm not going to fault teachers. I don't know if it's the teacher, and I don't want to bash millennials or students coming up. I've done my fair share of teaching. And the last bit of teaching, I just felt some of the young actors were more focused on what their brand was and less so on craft. In my mind, there was a lack of curiosity about what you were doing, about what they were doing and not asking enough questions. And there was a thing, and I'm not going to bash one technique over the other, but there was this notion, I don't know if this is really a technique, but this notion of if you just say the lines, the audience will get the character. That basically character is created in the mind of the audience, that the actor doesn't really create anything. He or she just says the lines and the audience creates. And I have a huge problem with that because in my mind, then I don't need an actor. I can do that myself by reading a novel or a book. I don't have to pay whatever Broadway prices are to see an actor stand there and just say the words and not imbue them with anything more, with a greater understanding or depth of what they're saying without having specific objectives or an action. Which I think is incumbent upon you as an actor. If you get on stage, you do have to do something. You just don't stand there. And I've been finding that or seeing that happening more and more and more. I think with some, not all, but with far too many young actors, this notion that, in fact, I've had two students in the past tell me that same thing. You didn't get it. I thought, if I just said it, you'd get it.
So what the, Alan, you have an acting background. Was it like this when you were coming through the system?
No. I disagree. I mean, I'm in your camp that I think part of what the actor's job is to do is to bring the intent, to bring the backstory. And I think some of my favorite conversations I've had are with people in ensembles who have created this entire world for this unnamed,
absolutely
unspoken character of why they're there, what they're doing, why they're selling flowers, why they're talking to that person. Like, that's part of the fun for doing it 8 times a week and to keep it fun, but also for the audience. Like, who is this person? What did they do before they just walked on stage?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's just the stale
absolutely.
Thing.
And I mean, and it's like, you know, it requires work. It requires work. It requires discipline. And I don't know. We can blame everything on social media. You can become an Insta star.
Yeah.
you know, you get enough followers or what have you. We have examples of it. So I don't know. There is the lure. People want to be stars. They want to be famous. They want to be seen. But shortcuts. People are even former students who have told me, you know, said, I keep hoping you'll say something that I'll just make it happen, that I'll just get it and I'll know what to do. And I'm always having to remind myself, you do realize this career that I have, I didn't have it right out of school. What you're seeing now has been 20, you know, some odd years, 20 plus years in the making. So I don't know why you think that it's going to happen for you in a year, 6 months. Sometimes they're a little deaf to that part. And, you know, it's hard. I guess you don't want to hear that it's going to be tough that it may not happen right away and that you may have to work very, very hard and sacrifice a great deal to kind of get where you'd like to be.
You've accomplished so many big things. Is there one passion project or is there something that you've yet to do that would just be a dream come true for you and be like, hey, I did it?
No. Because I've been asked this before a number of times, and this is the way I see it. If I get to do that thing, what then? Does that mean I'm done?
Well, no, not even in the sense that you're done.
There's so many other great. I've been fortunate enough. I've gotten to play some great, great roles and be a part of some great projects, which tells me that there are more great roles out there, more great projects yet to come. And so I try to keep myself open. I just want to do the next great thing. I want to have the next great experience because this is, you know, it's my bliss. It's the thing I want to do. So I'm just looking for the next great one. Whenever I was asked that question in grad school. I remember saying, you know, in all my self-regard, I said, you know what? I want to play Oedipus. And I want to play all three. I don't want to just do Rex. And I want to do all three of them. That would do it for me. And I got out of school, and within 5 years, I had done all three. So it's like, okay, now what?
Yeah.
So I guess I'm done. I've peaked. And it's not that. It's not that. I'm still very, very hungry. You know, that was that, and I'm grateful for it. But it's always like, what next? What's going to turn me on next? What's going to excite me? What's the next big challenge for me? So I don't have any one. It's just what's the next mountain to climb? How high can I get?
Yeah, that's great.
What am I going to see when I get up here?
First of all, we can't wait to see what that is. Before that, Michael, I talked earlier and we've talked about what you've done that's so great and how you got there, but I've got something really challenging in store for you.
Oh, no. Okay.
I want you to visualize this. It's the ninth inning. There's two outs. You've got to bring home the winning runs here. All right? We're going to play a little game called Fastball Derby.
Oh, okay. Got it.
So Fastball Derby, think of it like this. Hey, Angie got through it, your former castmate. Well, she got through one piece.
Angie Sharp. She's smart like that. She knows this stuff.
Just think of it like this. You know, all the pressure's on the line. I ask you a question. You say the first thing that comes to your mind. Give us some more insight into Michael Potts this way, all right? Let's see. Most challenging role you've ever had to play?
The priest in Mother Courage.
If you were a baseball player, which position would you be and why?
Left field, because very little comes out that way. Safest position for me.
Favorite New York City meal?
I have a lot of them. I would say Del Posto, the 100-layer lasagna from Del Posto's. That's it.
That sounds phenomenal.
Yeah, it is pretty phenomenal.
Most fun actor or actress you've ever gotten to work with?
Most fun. Actor or actress?
Mm-hmm.
Josh Gad. He's absolutely nuts. He keeps you laughing on stage or off. You have no idea where it's coming from, when it's coming, but he always gets you. Yeah.
Probably not surprised. It's nice to see that he's had this big film career.
Oh, I'm not surprised. Not surprised.
Most embarrassing onstage moment.
Well, it happens. It's happened a couple of times, but I would say it happened in the prom where I said half my line and I couldn't remember the rest. No. It was I'm supposed to be looking at the computer and I'm supposed to tell them how many views Emma's video has gotten. And it's supposed to be 6 million. And so I went, six. Choked and couldn't finish. Christopher Seaver had to whisper to me, million. I couldn't remember 6 million. I just got out six. That's it. That's it. That happens. That happens every now and then. You say one line and you can't remember the rest of it. Gone. I got nothing. Right. Help, help.
You probably played it off to the audience just fine. That's awesome. Favorite late night snack? Two show day at the Long Acre. You get home, it's after midnight. What's Michael Potts grab before he hits the couch?
Wine.
Red or white?
Red.
All right, there we go. Proudest moment of your career?
Oh, when my mom and the whole family came up to Yale in my third year and saw my last show, and she got it, that moment when she finally got it.
How does she feel now?
Well, she passed 5 years ago.
Very sorry.
But she was a very, very proud theater mom by the end of it. You know, she was gung-ho for things I thought she would never. I really thought, this very religious woman, I could not bring her to the Book of Mormon. And she came and she had the best time. So, yeah, I think that was it.
Lastly, what's the best piece of advice anyone ever gave you, and what was it?
Best anyone ever gave me. Well, I guess would be Earl Gister, acting teacher, which I try to remember a lot. And he would say, if they don't get it, you know, he had tracheotomy, says, if they don't get him and they don't get you, they don't appreciate it, fuck them.
And that'll be our first expletive-rated episode of Break a Bat. I love it. That's right, though. You got to stay true to yourself. Not enough people do. And I think that, and listen, I'm a millennial technically, but yeah, with this age of social media and whatnot, not enough people are really, you know, being pure to their truths. And I think that everything you talked about today, you know, it really hits home. It really does.
I hope so. Well, thank you.
That was awesome, wasn't it, Alan?
Totally. I really enjoyed that one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good.
Well, we can't wait.
Never know. I just like, okay. You said you wanted to interview me. Good luck. Hope you got something you can use.
Plenty and then some. Now, Michael, where can everyone find you on social media if they want to keep abreast of what you're doing?
Ooh, well, they probably, it'll bore them to tears because I'm really terrible at it. You can find me on Instagram, mpot62.
Awesome.
Or Twitter, Michael Potts NYC.
Wonderful.
Don't look for a lot of posting.
No.
I'm just not that interested.
Well, I'm sure our audience today certainly found plenty of interesting things and then some. And listen, it's been such an honor to sit and talk with you today. I can't thank
pleasure.
You enough.
No, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Fantastic. Well, that'll close out the ball game here on Break a Bat with my producer, Alan Seals, signing off.
Signing off.
We'll see you next time, folks.
Thanks for listening to Break a Bat. This is produced by the fine folks at the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit and subscribe at bpn.fm/breakabat. You can find me online at break_a_bat_podcast. And you can also find the Broadway Podcast Network on Instagram at Broadway Podcast Network. It's been so great having you here with us today, and we'll see you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.